What do the capitalist titan Jeff Bezos and communist kingpin Kim Jong-un have in common? Very likely they have absolutely nothing in common, but we will never know because both Amazon and North Korea are kingdoms of secrecy. Welcome to Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. I'm Christopher Keneally for Beyond the Book. This week, owing to a lengthy New York Times article that documented supposed Dickensian workplace practices at the Seattle-based e-tailer, Amazon was topic number one among the chattering classes. Andrew Albanese, at least, wonders whether Amazon deserves the opprobrium. The senior writer for Publishers Weekly joins me now, as he does every Friday. And welcome back to Beyond the Book, Andrew.
Greetings, Chris.
So we will get to Amazon in just a moment. I have to hold off, but I want to talk about something a little more, well, friendly, if we will, children's books. And we don't often talk about children's books on this show, but this week we will do that because the New York Times has announced that it's changing the way it calculates its bestseller list for as far as children's books go. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's right. Starting this week, the New York Times is going to tweak its children's bestseller list for the first time, separating hardcover middle grade books and YA titles from paperback and ebook bestsellers. And the hardcover lists are going to appear in print, while the paperback and the ebook lists are only going to be available in the online edition of the Times. Pamela Paul, who's the editor of the New York Times Book Review, told PW that the changes were meant to be more useful for readers, for authors, and for publishers in helping them discover titles. And she said that separating YA and middle grade would actually help parents because, you know, The Hunger Games is a very different read from the books of Rebecca Stead. In a post on the Times website, Paul posits that readers, authors, and publishers are going to be actually happy to see more diversity in these newly reconfigured lists. But she says that she has also already received some complaints. So my two cents on this is, well, this is one way, maybe the only way, to knock John Green off a bestseller list. But I think there's probably going to be a few immediate challenges to navigating this change for publishers in terms of how they categorize things. You know, in her explanation, Paul brings up the two diverse examples, The Hunger Games and the works of Rebecca Stead. But, you know, the bulk of works published are not so starkly different as those kinds of books. So if you're a publisher, are you going to be shooting for your book to be picked up on the YA list or on the middle grade list? Is it going to be a concern for how you, what audience you shoot for there, or how you target your metadata? She also mentions discovery. But I would add that in addition to discovery, the great value of the New York Times bestseller list is, of course, that it's a tremendous marketing tool. You know, there's lots of ways to make a book discoverable today, but being a New York Times bestseller is a singularly important marketing opportunity. So we'll see how the shakeup affects, you know, maybe how publishers of YA and middle grade books begin to approach the way they do things. And I think you can expect much more in the coming weeks as this change rolls out as to how it's working, whether it's working. But I think the move actually makes a lot of sense. And in terms of the things that publishers have to adjust to in this ever-changing digital age, you know, this one is a pretty low-grade challenge.
Yeah, probably so. Considering all the other things, as you say, they are working on. And this week, the New York Times has been hard at work because they've made a lot of news as opposed to only reporting the news. And so here's our chance now to talk about the big subject that's dominating not only talk in publishing circles, but the national news as well. And that's the New York Times expose on Amazon's working conditions. As someone who's covered Amazon for a long time, I'm sure you've got a lot of different thoughts on that, and share them with us.
Yeah, you know, well, you know, I'm probably going to get in trouble over this, and I've resisted the urge to join in the discussion on listservs and other things that I'm on with publishers, but I have a few reactions, and the first of which to me is that when I first read the story, it felt to me like a hit piece. But at the same time, that such a piece could ever come out in the Times, I think falls, in my opinion, almost completely on Amazon's shoulders. And not only because I don't doubt that some of the anecdotes in the article are true, but because, you know, the company is just so shrouded in secrecy.
All right, so let's take this one at a time. Why do you think this reads like a hit piece?
Well, you know, first I have to emphasize that I'm certainly not condoning any of the alleged behavior from Amazon managers in this article. I mean, it certainly does not sound like a great place to work, but I wonder if maybe that was the point of the article, to make it sound like not such a great place to work. And I say that because, you know, I've been a little concerned by David Streitfeld's coverage of Amazon and of his Authors United coverage, because, you know, I've found it to be, you know, at worst, biased and at best lacking some much needed depth. In so many of his pieces, whenever he gets a chance to present a more critical or nuanced view of Amazon's behaviors or the publisher's behaviors or Authors United's claims, he tends to present more glib comments or rest on assumptions. And even the Times public editor has called him out on that. But beyond Streitfeld's work, the Times editorial board has also penned op-eds against Amazon, you know, most recently in its Hachette battle last year, despite not really knowing the facts of that battle. And also the editor said that the publisher's collusion in the ebooks market, in the ebooks case, excuse me, actually led to a healthier ebook market, which I think is untrue by the numbers. And it was specifically rebutted by Judge Denise Coate in her decision, which was also buttressed by an appeals court decision recently. And of course, you know, Jeff Bezos owns the Times as competition, online at least, which is the Washington Post. So I don't know, that can't hurt either. But I have to say that reading this six-month investigative piece kind of took the cake for me because it appeared designed not to question Amazon's business, but its very humanity. You know, to me, it really read like a wagging finger in the face of the consumer saying, okay, maybe you like lower prices on books, and maybe you like the convenience that Amazon provides, but how can you support this? How can you support this kind of behavior? You know, and I've seen a lot of reactions online from consumers who are now talking about boycotting Amazon. If you look at the Times comments, there's some in there as well, or others who are just saying they're going to dump Amazon, that this is a bridge too far for them. And put aside the fact that actually boycotting Amazon would cut into their sales, but I wonder why consumers would boycott Amazon over behavior that Wall Street and the publishers always reward. You know, I've never understood why it's my responsibility as a consumer to act against my own self-interest and dump Amazon. And why now? Because poor Bo Olson saw people cry at his desk because Amazon is a hard place to work. You know, never mind how Apple makes its iPhones or pays its taxes or how Nike makes its shoes or how Walmart has workers that put in 60-hour weeks and still have to go on public assistance. God forbid Americans ever saw how a hot dog got made. You know, it would be the end of that grand old American treat. Now, I fully take the point that a lot of people are making about how work life in America has evolved. And I understand that this Amazon piece is part of a number of pieces that the Times is doing on this that are actually very good. You know, there was a piece on Goldman Sachs also this week on the work environment there. And I'm really happy to have that discussion. But still, this piece kind of stood out alone because this piece was really about Amazon. And, you know, it's not about skilled workers everywhere in workplaces. This piece was specifically about Amazon and anecdotally portrayed Amazon was like the 10th ring of hell to work in. It kind of sideways alluded to innovation and lucrative stock options for these oppressed workers. But, you know, these workers are not in camps. They can leave. They can also get rich. You know, and all of my friends who work on Wall Street actually laughed at this piece because, you know, their work environments, they say, are significantly more difficult. So I can only imagine, you know, what other industries are thinking about this piece as well. But the big question that I took away from reading this piece goes back to the point I made about consumer boycotts. And that's, if Amazon is so evil to work with and now so apparently bad to work for, why are publishers and suppliers still working with them? You know, God forbid we have to buy our books from another retailer, right? You know, the way I see it is if you want to put out a fire, the best way is to cut off its oxygen. So if you think Amazon is killing the publishing industry, well, stop, you know, signing the contracts and putting out the nice statements saying we're delighted to have Amazon as our partner. The best way is to cut off its oxygen, as I say, not to throw a bucket of cold water on it. And this article to me felt like a big cup of cold water.
Yeah, all right. So let's say the article wasn't fair. How does that make it Amazon's fault?
Yeah. Well, you know, whether or not the article was fair, it's absolutely Amazon's fault because they are like North Korea when it comes to information. And anybody who works in the publishing industry or covers the industry knows that. You know, why can David Streitfeld print things that I find to be assumptions about Amazon? Because Amazon will never correct him. There's no access. There's no transparency. There's virtually no information from Amazon. And in that vacuum, you get a lot of fear. You get a lot of I didn't even mention the non-disclosure agreements. You've got a lot of people who can't even talk about their work conditions because, you know, they're barred from doing so. The Times article read to me like the full North Korea treatment of Amazon, too. You know, it read like this peek behind the curtain at a terrifying regime, you know, complete with refugee profiles. But You know, it's this combination, I think, of Amazon's secrecy, its growing power, and its reputation for not playing well with others that creates the kind of perfect conditions for this kind of, you know, really negative, scathing piece to emerge. Now, again, none of this is to discount the fact that there probably is, and definitely reading from the article, probably are some horrible working conditions for some employees, certainly by certain managers at Amazon who appear not to have any empathy at all from this article. And I think we do need to have a discussion about how we work in America and what's required of us to be innovative. But you know, I am still left wondering why Amazon got this 5,400-word piece in the Sunday paper. And I'm certainly not suggesting that it's a conspiracy against the company by the New York Times, but I do see a certain animus at work here. And I don't know whether that's because Amazon is bad or because Amazon is feared or powerful or maybe all of the above. And I'll just say in a closing note that, you know, you should read Margaret Sullivan, the public editor of the Times, her criticisms of the article. I think that they're pretty good. Also, Dean Baquette, who's the managing editor at the Times, has responded to those as well. He loves the piece. And the comments, there's almost 6,000 comments on the article, and they are more interesting, I think, than the article itself. So I'm not sure the article was entirely fair, but I do think it has generated a pretty interesting discussion.
Well, indeed, and you know, I appreciate that very interesting analysis, Andrew. And, you know, the article, the New York Times article, did precipitate finally some comment from Jeff Bezos. And in part, he said that, you know, that sort of thing isn't going to happen anymore. And people were going to have to show more empathy at Amazon. And if they didn't, they would be fired immediately.
Well, you know, one thing I think we all know about Amazon from covering them, in addition to the fact that there's no information and lots of secrecy and little access, if any, is that they're always pushing suppliers for, you know, deeper discounts. And they're always hitting people hard whenever they can to return more value to them. Would not expect anything different to apply to their workforce as well. Whether or not it crosses the line to inhumane, which is rather what this piece suggested, I think is open to question. But I'm not surprised at all that it's not a very nice place to work, because it's certainly not an easy place to cover or an easy place to negotiate with.
All right. Well, Andrew Albanese, we appreciate your perspective as always. Andrew Albanese, senior writer for Publishers Weekly, joins us every Friday on Beyond the Book. Thanks so much.
My pleasure, as always.
Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker for the world's most sought-after materials, including millions of books and ebooks, journals, newspapers, magazines, and blogs, as well as images, movies, and television shows. You can follow Beyond the Book on Twitter, find us on Facebook, and subscribe to the free podcast series on iTunes or at our website, beyondthebook.com. Our engineer and co-producer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. My name is Christopher Keneally. For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book.